Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast gentle enough to use every day. But we do it once a week, so space it out if you can. I mean, yeah, you can listen to it over and over, but don't get all mental about it. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun podcast with Tom Wilson. That's right. I named it that because the Tom Wilson show just wasn't as interesting. And Big Pop Fun was some, hey, I already had a website that was called Big Pop Fun. I figured whatever, marketing tie-ins. And so far, that's working out perfectly. Welcome to another edition of Big Pop Fun, a magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we climb aboard the roller coaster of life. The ups and downs. It's like the Himalaya of life. Do you remember that ride, the Himalaya? Boy, I love that ride. The Himalaya was, yeah, a roller coaster, of course. You got those old wooden roller coasters that were a lot of fun. And then the whole steel loop-the-loopy roller coasters, which I think, I don't know, it's a very crazy ride, but it's awfully smooth. My tummy doesn't feel good on the really smooth roller coasters. They go roundy, roundy, round. I don't like those very much. But I did like the Himalaya, which goes roundy, round. But I think so many of them were so poorly made that it was really clackety, clackety, clackety. So you felt like you were going to die at any moment, and that would push aside any motion sickness. The Himalaya was a round ride. It was like a roller coaster that went up and down on these hills like the Himalayas. And I don't know, it was the coolest ride in certainly in Wildwood, New Jersey, when I used to go to Wildwood, New Jersey with my family. So it would go around and around. It had, and they would play rock and roll music, that crazy rock and roll. I don't know, the Beatles or whomever, you know, in the late 70s, they'd play disco, but it had one of those gigantic disco balls in the center of it. And these colored spotlights would hit the disco ball. And so it looked like it was snowing inside in the summertime. And it was it was just beautiful. The Himalaya would go faster and faster around in this circle, and it looked like it was snowing, and the disco ball was going, and they were playing loud rock and roll music, and it would go faster and faster up and down. And then, much like our lives, after being on the Himalaya for a long time, you screamed for it to go backwards and began to get a little sick. So yeah, everyone would be screaming for the Himalaya to go backwards, and then just dramatically, it had to be dramatic. The Himalaya would slow down, and you know, everyone's starting to scream, and the announcer, the poor kid in the booth, you know, the kid with the, probably in the late 70s, he was wearing a members only jacket with sunglasses at night, and a microphone in the glass booth that was kind of a fake DJ looking booth, because he was, of course, spinning the platters. Anyway, the Himalaya would stop, and then he would announce on the loudspeaker in an unprofessional voice, "And now the Himalaya will go backwards." And everyone would scream, and then the music would start again, and then backwards over the hills, the fake hills, and through this tunnel. It had a tunnel, didn't it? It had a tunnel up at the sort of the top of it, and the tunnel had images like skiers and snowmen and stuff, and you went through this tunnel and came. Anyway, I don't know where I went with that tangent, but life is like the Himalaya. Just keep riding it, people, all the way to the Big Pop Fun podcast, which is a magical sleigh ride, not unlike the Himalaya. I'm going to glue tiny mirrors all over my head, get myself a flashlight, and start spinning in this room as I speak to you. I will be the human disco ball. I like talking to artists on the show, and I like talking to artists that I respect a lot. And Ann Cusack is one of those people. Anne, I met Anne many years ago. She was the star of a sitcom on Lifetime Television for Women. It was called Maggie. She was the star of it. I came on as I came on for one episode, and then they made me a recurring character. Fortunately, if you do one episode of a show and you get a couple of good lines in, oh, a couple jokes, then the producers go, oh, well, we should bring that character back. So I got to come back on a number of episodes. John Slattery was – I played his like best friend from college, and we were – boy, John and I had a lot of fun on that show. John is now on Mad Men. You would certainly know John to see him. He's been quite prominent, and he's the star of the movie The Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon. And so John is very, very busy out there, and I'd love to have him on the podcast one day. But he wasn't the star of Maggie for Lifetime Television for Women. That was Anne Cusack. Anne is an actress of wide and long experience. She has, I didn't know, you know, until our conversation, I didn't know how early her theater training went, but I did know she's from Chicago. And as we talk about, Chicago was a hotbed of improvisation, of theater games. You know, I mean, we're Second City and Paul Sills and all the story theater, all kinds of things. Well, Anne was involved in all of those things, and I could have talked to her for 18 hours about that stuff. But she is from the very famous Cusack artist family. There are five Cusacks that many are. She tells me there's a painter, there are actors. I mean, John and Joan and all, you know, all sorts of Cusacks. And I found that fascinating. But I really enjoyed speaking with Anne a lot. And I hope you enjoy listening to my conversation with Anne Cusack.
Hi, it's Big Pop Fun.
Anne Cusack is here, I should just say. And we're talking. We were already talking, and I already blew big stuff because we were we already had good things before I even turned it on.
Oh, this is true. This is true. So you're picking up. It's almost like there was a pause on the video.
Yeah.
And we've lifted the pause, and we're continuing on.
But it's still interesting.
Well, sure.
That's the thing.
Right. How can it not be?
But you sing.
And you do.
Well, I sing. That.
And your imaginary band is?
My imaginary band is the Liberty Bell Singers from a small group, six quite overweight people from central Pennsylvania.
Really?
Who helped back me up.
Are they of Dutch
in
background?
Mostly Pennsylvania Dutch, yes.
Pennsylvania Dutch,
so
okay.
They paint signs.
They paint signs?
For the sides of barns, Villa Coleman, that kind
of
stuff.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And they have, they make apple skeeblers, and they sing.
That's fit, apple skeeblers. When is the last time someone has ever said that word?
I don't think it's ever been said
in Southern California.
It was made up, I think.
Really?
They have apple skeebleries. I don't know what the word is, but up in Solvang here in California, don't they?
Solvang.
Up the coast.
Oh, my God.
With the little hut.
That
the
is
little.
Town.
Solvang is a town with the little huts. And
I know
the,
it is.
And they make the they pay pea soup.
Who doesn't want a nice pea soup?
And apple skeeblers. Anyway, apple where skeeblers. Do you sing? How do you, what, do, what well, let's say, what do you sing? What kind of stuff do you sing?
Blues.
You sing the blues?
Yeah, I'm a Chicago gal.
Ah.
So I sing the blues with a band called Blues Adjacent because we're mostly over 30 and primarily white.
So Blues Adjacent?
Blues Adjacent.
Are you really not allowed to have the blues if you're white? Is that it?
No.
Because there are a lot of, you know.
No. But, I mean, the roots of blues and jazz come from, you know, around the sort of the Louisiana area and Storyville. That's where it initially came up. And jazz and musical theater are two art forms that were created in the United States.
Musical theater, really? I mean,
yes. I'm serious.
I know by your face that you're serious, and I know that in that especially in like the American, the immigrants to America,
yes.
Italian, Irish immigrants, mm-hmm. Would have these musical presentations
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
were very very early versions mm-hmm. of what we've come to know as musical theater mm-hmm. of the Rodgers and Hammerstein mm-hmm. of Oklahoma or
mm-hmm,
whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But do you think that was the roots of a theater piece that actually had song in it? Because weren't there in Europe, weren't there kind of theatrical pieces like that?
Well, I think they were called opera.
Well, sure, if you're singing all the time.
If you sing everything.
Everything, that's opera.
Everything is an opera.
Yeah.
People have even debated that Les Mis is actually an opera.
Well, it is, sort of. It is an opera.
It is, isn't it? Because there isn't really one word spoken.
No, no. So and off point, but have you seen the movie?
No, I haven't.
Dude.
Really?
Unbelievable.
Do you know? Oh, okay.
Unbelievable.
Really?
I know. You're a tough crowd, right?
Yeah.
Yes, especially for musical theater, right?
I'm afraid I am, because I'm not as tough in it.
Right. Well, me too.
Did you?
Me too. But I hate everything. I hate everything. I hate everything. And I freely admit that. I am not fun. I'm not fun to go to a movie with. You shouldn't go with me. Don't go. Or a theater. A theater at the intermission. I'm the guy who says, why?
I
mean, what? An hour and, come on.
Really?
Really, playwright?
Huh. Learn your craft.
Yes.
Experiment on me.
And of course, like.
What are your top five ones then? What are the ones that you actually like?
What, movies?
Sure. Let's start with that.
Movies.
Since you hate everything.
I do hate everything. I loved the movie My Dinner with Andre.
Really?
Yes.
Do you have the action figures?
I have. No. I did have the scooter that Wallace Shawn actually rode to the subway when it was a McDonald's with a Happy Meal. It came with. It was a small, and it comes with the Wallace Shawn figure.
Oh.
And he does small solo performances in people's apartments.
That's fantastic. Well, he would be small.
Yeah.
He's little.
He's small to begin with. So imagine a Wallace Shawn action figure. Tiny.
Out of play.
I love that. I love, in mainstream movies, what did I love? I love Field of Dreams, because it was a movie to watch that was like, it was not predictable.
No, you didn't.
At the halfway point, you didn't know what was going on in this movie.
So if you were on a desert island, would these be two that you would take with you?
Probably.
Over and over and over and over.
Probably. Okay. But I do love a lot of movies. I don't hate.
Any Peter Sellers? Do you like any Peter Sellers?
Well, I love. Yeah, sure. Doctor Strangelove is just for his improvisations with the Russian premier Dmitry on the phone, when he's just on the phone. Yes, Dmitry.
Okay, I want you to notice, okay, the next time you see Dr. Strangelove, do you know the scene when he's sitting in the wheelchair and he's trying to keep his hand down?
Sure, he's trying to do the Nazi salute.
Okay, now if you look at him and just slightly to the left, there is a guy standing there and he's cracking up.
Oh, really?
Yes, and that's the only take they got where he wasn't completely laughing.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can see him trying really hard not to laugh.
Well, yeah, it's a very funny, funny movie.
Oh,
so I love Peter Sellers,
movie.
I mean, being there, and so many. I mean, The Party, Peter Sellers is just a tremendous comedic actor.
Yes.
So I don't hate everything. I suppose I hate modern things, and it's not, I guess, being the old cranky guy or whatever. I just think that it's very processed now. That when you're spending $150 million on a movie,
yeah.
Yes, it's very much through the committee mm-hmm. of suits in order for everyone to okay the mm-hmm. story and okay the budget and okay everything. So it has to go
right.
A, B, C, and we know what's going to happen before it happens in the movie.
Right? There's no, we're not surprised.
And I saw the musical Les Miserables. I knew it was going to happen.
And you still liked it.
But I am like every actor. Of course, I'm filled with hatred and resentment when Hugh Jackman gets cast as Jean Valjean. Of course, Hugh Jackman's Jean Valjean. How could Hugh Jackman not be? He's everybody.
Well, and he also has been on Broadway in musicals.
Yes, he has. Yes, he certainly has. I give him all due respect.
Okay.
But just like the young girls, say, Anne Hathaway, oh sure, Pretty Pretty Princess gets to be Fantine in Les Miserables. They're both absolutely stunningly unbelievable.
Oh, I'll have to go see it.
Yes, I saw it with a very strong industry crowd, who is famous for being. Being judgmental about things and like arousing, rousing long standing ovation for it. So I look forward to hearing what you think.
All right. I'm going to go out and see it.
What was the first musical that you did? You grew up in Chicago. Were you always, I mean, what did you do when you were a kid? Were you always putting together plays in the backyard?
No, I sort of did. Yeah. I started improvising and doing like literary story theater and coming out of the.
Paul Sills Story Theater. So you were, at what age are you actually going out in Chicago and studying these things?
Well, I started when I was 9 with Byrne and Joyce Piven, who they had come out of the University of Chicago Compass Players, and the Compass Players were like Elaine May, Mike Nichols, Del Close, Maya Kolb, this whole. You know, they kind of started this whole comedy,
of course,
literary kind of stuff. So they were part of the Compass Players, and then when they left the University of Chicago, Second City formed, and then they formed their own studio, which was more using the theater games and improvisation as a way of training the actor. And Second City went more on the comedy, went more on the comedy route, which is what it's known for. So I started doing that when I was about 9.
But at 9, was that you? I mean, were mom and dad active? I mean, were they actors? It was just an interest like dance class and you just went to theater class?
Well, it was kind of like that. I mean, my mom was from Boston. She was, my father was from New York City. I mean, it was one of those things where if you're, you know, her growing up and what her parenting skills or, you know, philosophy was, is you give your kids lots of different things to try to do. So, you know, we were middle class family and, you know, we'd go to arts and crafts or I'd go to camp and we would take, you know, theater classes. It was all using those things as a way of developing your kids, you know, to trying to go to, you know, in the summer there would be like down at the local kind of beach, they would have like a kind of a summer camp where we'd learn how to sail or you would, you know, learn how to canoe or you go to Girl Scout camp or something like that. So it was kind of, they viewed it as sort of, that was one of those different, you know, the different things that you did. And it's also a way of finding out what kind of skills your kids are good at or like or all that kind of stuff. So I don't think they expected it to take off as it did in my particular family.
How many siblings do you have?
There's 5 of us.
5.
And then, you know, John has done really, really well, and so has Joni. And you know, I've been holding my own. Not quite as, you know, have their careers as they did. My other brother is also an actor and a painter and a writer, and then my youngest sister is also an actress and a dancer and a poet.
So all 5.
Yeah.
How do you think that happened? Was that a seed that mom and dad planted, or did everyone look out there and do all sorts of stuff? And John did scouting, and Joni did this, and you were ended up in the class at 9. But everyone gravitated toward the arts.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like there's some. I mean, it's unusual to have there's a lot of other families.
Well, I know a painter friend of mine who has maybe a dozen painters in the family. Yeah. I mean, everyone gravitated to that.
Yeah, I think certain families, you know, the genes or the makeup or the conditioning, you know, some are lawyers, some are doctors, some are psychics, some are artists.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we kind of went that route for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Just a bunch of kids and why did you keep going? Was it internally within you, the sharing of something that was inside of you as a 9, 10, 11-year-old? Or were you one of those kids that was getting, you know, positive feedback really early and you said, I'm kind of good at this?
Well, I think it was like kind of a combination. I mean, when you're a kid, it's all about attention, isn't it, from your parents and around and all that stuff. One, it was really fun. The games were really, really fun. We didn't know that we were getting trained. We were just playing these theater games, which were specifically kind of developed certain things that you need to have, skills that you need to have as an actor. But actually, more importantly, as a person, you know, as far as, which I think is the importance of the arts anyway, regardless of whether you're going to be a, you know, a painter, a movie star, a rock star, if that's even what you want to be, which is sort of, I wouldn't wish that on anybody because they're such strange lives.
What, rock star or all of those things?
All of those things. Whenever you get to that sort of level of like profile and money and fame. It's a very, very strange ride. It's a very strange reality. But I think it's really more important for the development of a person, of a human being, developing creativity and how you can look outside of the box. And, you know, if you, it teaches you certain, you know, the individual versus, you know, the ensemble. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like
even individual versus the ensemble. Yes. What do you mean?
Well, say for instance, I mean, I love this particular metaphor. It's kind of like a band. And we're all sort of members of a band, and each band member has an instrument. Some people sing, some people play the keyboard, some people play the saxophone, some the triangle, whatever. I'm kidding about that. But you don't have music unless everybody is committed to their instrument. So you have to be committed to who you are and what you're contributing to the music. So the music is the song is the larger, sort of sense of community. And then everybody has to, you know, fully play their instrument in order for us to have music or to sing song or to express something of meaning or fun or make you dance or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a bunch of bass players, you have a bunch of bass players, but you don't really have a great song. Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
So I think what the arts do is help develop everybody's individual sense of themselves, because you can feel the value of who you are. You can have someone say, and a lot of people don't even have this, say, you know, you're matter. Your behavior may be debatable, but you are not. You are of value. What you have to say, what your talents, what your skills are important. So what are they? We want to see them. We need you to fully commit to yourself so you can be a part of society or community or your family or have healthy relationships, whatever it is. We need you to be fully who you are. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Otherwise, we can't see and engage and interact in ways that are healthy. You know what I mean?
Do you think this is off the top of my head, so I don't really know what I'm asking here. But
right.
I mean, within our culture now, you learned to both learn your instrument and be part of the orchestra.
Yeah.
Does through our society today, do you think we have too many soloists? Do you
yes,
know what I'm kind
I
of
do.
Saying?
Yes, I do.
And a non-recognition of your illustration of the band.
Well, I think what's happening is that there's certain. I think there's certain communities around the United States, whether it's in Los Angeles or anywhere else, that seem to really kind of. A village raises a kid kind of thing, where you have that sense of you in relationship to other people, and how we have to, we're all coexisting, and you help someone else, you're also helping yourself in a way. We're mirrors of one another. All those kinds of ideas. I think that there's we shouldn't have nonprofits in this country. Nonprofits serve a very, very important need, whether it's on health issues, whether it's arts, whether it's kids, whether it's environmental. If this society and people were really functioning on the level that it should, we shouldn't have nonprofits. But because, and the nonprofits are designed to help an individual, environmentally that would be, but still environmentally, that affects people because we're living and we don't want to be living in a toxic world or all that stuff. But nonprofits, from my understanding, are to help an individual have a life of quality so that they like who they are, they like another person, you understand the value of your life, you enjoy your life, you are contributing, you're able to be independent, self-sufficient. If you can take care of yourself, then you can, it's like putting the mask on first and then you help somebody else,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. So I feel like I'm kind of all over the map with this. So it's they're supposed to help people become more you know, empowered and living the lives that they want to. And if you're living a life that you're helpful, then you can help somebody else get to that place too. And I think that a lot of the soloists are people who have not been fundamentally been able to take care of themselves, or did not get the help. So there's this incredible need to be seen and heard. I mean, you look at any of the talk shows on television. I mean, why would anybody put their most profound and painful situations in the front of millions of people? Why? I mean, it's...
Isn't it a form of modern theater?
Well, it is. But, you know, it's become that way.
And I agree with you that it's damaging. It's damaging. It's damaging to the people participating. It's damaging to the viewer. It's, I think, incredibly damaging even to the audience.
But it is the modern arena. It is. I mean, and it's very voyeuristic, and it's very bizarre to be watching. You know, you're watching people who are just—it's roadkill. It's just so disturbing in that way. But yet, these people are in such a place that they are willing to or want to go on national television, and have their lives, their experiences completely like taken apart by a host, or have these. I mean, what is that? There's somehow on a fundamental level, people do not feel they're being seen and heard. You know, the biggest thing about, I think, therapy anyway, or any of the art forms, are it's about being heard. Like, I see you. You matter. What's happening to you is important, as it is, say, for me in my own life, you know, or you in your own life. So it's kind of, There's something that the communication or people's skills at listening and hearing and seeing are there's something off there, and you know, I don't know whether it is that, you know, 15 minutes of fame, you know, or that there's so much external validation, you know, that people don't value their own feelings or thoughts or go, you know, I'm worth it, you know, I don't need you to acknowledge who or what I am. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I appreciate if you do care or like, but, you know, I'm not going to fall into this kind of deep ditch if you don't value me.
Where did that come from? Your sense of self, your sense that I have an intrinsic value, I have something to share, you don't?
I don't really. I speak to what I aspire to have. No.
But you did. I mean, your mom and dad or your family?
No, I did. I was very fortunate in that I did have parents that said, you know, they loved me. You know, I actually had that. And that they cared about what I was doing and did their best to try to help me go for the dreams that I wanted to do and go for. So I was very, very fortunate in that regard.
So that was a very strong foundation.
Well, that was strong. But, you know, you have a bunch of crazy artists. You're going to have some wacky hijinks. So in good ways and also challenging ways. I mean, I think the arts and having been through the Piven Theater Workshop, you know, from 9 to 18, I think that had a very profound effect in terms of, because I think the creative arts, and I think sports do this too, although it brings in a competition component, which brings in a whole other sort of dynamic. But I think the arts, no matter what form you take, whether it's the visual, whether it's painting, whether it's music, whether it's dance, the creative process is where you feel the value of who you are. It's not an idea. It's not in your head. You feel it on a physical and emotional level. So that's the importance of it, I think.
Is the feeling of it that you feel in the doing of it?
It's a combination. Doing the games or being involved in the creative process, writing is also can be that way. That process, I think, initially, you feel it by doing it. And then once you've accumulated the experience of it over, say, a period of time or certain events, then you begin to know that to be true of yourself. Well, no, I, I, I know that because the other part of it that it does, which is where I think the knowing eventually comes in, is the developing of the intuition and the instincts, so that you have that feeling. It's like, oh no, that's not, no, I shouldn't be doing that. That's not good. Okay. Oh, this feels good. Yeah, I'll do that. And you start to learn to trust your instincts and listen to that voice, that deeper voice or whatever you want to call it in you, that is a guide in a way to what's going to be good or not for you. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that also, that voice that you don't question what it tells you. If you really listen and develop and trust it, that it's like, no, I am of worth. No, this is good. Yeah, no, I like who I am. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you went through this very intense training of theater games, of improvisation.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know it was that's
right.
What's happening.
But as you know now, I mean, it's a seminal movement within the American and even world theater you were a part of between the ages of 9 and 18. Mm-hmm. Now, when did you become a professional actress at 18? Did you go away to school at 18?
I went away to school because that was also part, you know, my parents, part of their, you know, parenting was is that, you know, and I was also the oldest of five, so I was expected to go to college. I mean, it was assumed, it was expected. I don't think my parents necessarily thought we were all going to go into the arts or go into film and television and have the kind of careers that a lot of us have had. But it was, you know, that's what was expected. So I ended up going to a conservatory program for a couple of years and then transferred and went to New York University and then graduated from there. So
you stayed within a very high level of acting training, which I, you know, you didn't go off to, mm-hmm. you know, this very intense Chicago training mm-hmm. and off to some college where you were doing arsenic and old lace.
Right.
You know, I mean, you stayed within mm-hmm. Within a very intense training program.
Well, I learned a lot of different approaches and techniques to acting. You know, coming from a literary story, theater, improvisation, Bales, Sills, and Piven's work. I mean, that's a very different way of approaching than it is, say, going to a conservatory program where you have, you know, you have a voice and speech class, you have a movement class, you have a scene study class, you have a dialect class.
Was it challenging to move from such a kind of wide-ranging experimental foundation and into a classical training situation?
It was just different. It's a kind of a adjustment, which is good in terms of your, if you are going to be an actor or do that, in terms of your ability to be flexible in that way. I mean, I had worked in a more integrated way where the games were designed to you had a point of concentration or you had a point of focus. And so then by the calls that you would make, that would transform it. So you could emphasize a particular area, whether you wanted to do transformation or emotional transformations, or you wanted to physically become more strong or flexible or whatever it was. So you were always working on a whole. And so then to go to something where you were it felt more compartmentalized to me to go into a scene study class where you were just focusing on the scene, or you were going into a movement class and just focusing on movement. There wasn't a class where you were, the scene study class, I think, was where you were supposed to integrate it all.
Mm-hmm. Into a character in a specific situation in a play.
But it was the way it was designed, it didn't really help very much. It just made it more weird and awkward. I really got to see the different schools of thought. And it does, you know, as everybody is truly an individual, certain ideas and techniques and methodology, if I even want to say that, because there's so many different kinds of people, certain ones are going to work better for others.
Can I ask just because there are many people listening who aren't familiar with theater training or with talking to actors.
We can always segue to another topic.
No. I'm fascinated by it. But what is an idea of one game that you would play in a training situation like that, a Viola Spolin or, okay, or a Piven okay. School,
right,
so people would understand what the actors do.
Right,
they're up on stage.
If you were going to do like the Viola Spolin and Paul, you know, the Piven Theater Workshop sort of games, I can give you one. I'll give you an example. I can give you two. One. Everybody knows the game tag, right?
Right.
Okay. So you can play anywhere from 10 to 20 people if you want to with tag. So the way you would transform tag into, say, a theater game was by the call you would make. And say, for instance, I wanted to, you know, some of the people were not really in their bodies very much. They needed to kind of... they're really in their head, and they tend to be very tight, and they need to sort of open up and loose.
To be just moving freely and comfortably within their body on stage.
Yeah, freeze, right. Thank you for that. So what I would do is say I would make a call where we're going to play tag, but there's a couple rules. One, when someone gets tagged, everybody in the room has to freeze. So it's not just one person getting tagged in. Everybody keeps moving. Everybody has to develop that awareness that you're in relationship to other people at all times. So you have to develop that kind of sixth sense, that thing, that other part where you're playing the game, but you're aware of what else is going on around you, which you need to have when you're doing a play or when you're rehearsing or when you're working. So I would say tag you, and then everybody in the room has to freeze. Then I can call and say, all right, let's pretend that you are all on a very, very thin ice. Now, this ice is really thin, and that if you're not careful, you are going to go into freezing water. So I want you to play the game, but I want you to imagine, I want you to sort of create for yourselves and everybody in the room that you're all on very, very thin ice. Now, how is that going to affect the way you move and how you play the game? So if you're on ice and you don't have skates, you're probably going to be slipping. You have to be careful. It affects how you move. And then we could go, all right, now you're on a bed of hot coals and you don't have any shoes on. You're on ice. You're on a pogo stick. You're on a tightrope that's 100 feet off, and you have no net, and I want you to play the game. So, and then you can make other calls like, all right, do it in slow motion. So you have to play the game. You still have to play that game, that sense of urgency, that focus, that concentration, that objective to tag the other person, but let these other things affect you. So you start developing how you are physically moving, and it's also really, really fun.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be one way in terms of like that also develops like where are you? How where you are affects how you move. So when you're creating on stage an imaginary world, if it's cold, if you're outside in the play, you have to create the illusion that it's cold. It's not, but you have to create that illusion so that the audience believes you. So it's developing that ability to try to learn how to create the illusion of where you are or what you're, that kind of thing. Another game is called To Get. And basically it's two people. And one person is trying to get the other person to do something. And it can be anything from like, I want your set of keys to will you marry me? So you can take it on any kind of levels. So this game is really great because you have that objective. Now, it's set up from the very beginning that the person wanting to get, say, the keys from you are never, ever going to give me those keys. It doesn't matter what I say, what I do, you are never going to give me that set of keys. So you've already set up this conflict. You've already set up this sort of challenge. And then what happens is you place it like, where are you? Okay, we're in the kitchen and we're cooking Christmas dinner. Or it's Shabbat and we're going to have dinner, whatever it is. So you're preparing. You have this physical world that you're doing. And then you throw in a relationship. Like, okay, this is your brother. This is your grandmother. This is a total stranger. And how, and this is a game that explores relationships, among other things, how who you are to one another affects how you go about getting what you want. And so often in a play or also in real life, you're in that situation where you really need something very, very badly, and they're not giving it to you, so what do? So you're exploring the different ways in which you go about trying to get what you want. It's not a game about manipulation so much, but about how the relationships affect how you go about getting something and you want. And it's very important that the stakes are really high so that it's not lukewarm. Mm-hmm. You cannot be lukewarm about it. It's like, this is life and death, and you play it that way. So that's another example.
Excellent. I'm just looking at the time. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
No, you're not. I don't know if this is really interesting so much or if I'm articulating.
I find it very interesting, and I think you're articulating it very well. But coming from such a free background, so organic within the relationships you have on stage, within the moving your body. Did you start just, when did you say, you know, I think I'm going to act for money. I think I'm going to, you know, I'm going to buy bread and cheese and have a roof over my head doing this.
Well, I never thought I would.
You didn't?
No, I never thought that I would get paid for.
Even in NYU?
Well, I wanted to, but I, you know, it's the odds of one making it in this industry are just beyond comprehension. I mean, I thought maybe I would, you know, I would always have some kind of other job, and I might be in a, you know, theater company that we're all struggling. I mean, I wanted to be able to make a living, you know, acting.
But NYU, did you go back to Chicago after school?
I did. I ended up working a year at the Goodman Theater as the artistic staff assistant. And to this day, I want to apologize to Greg Mosher, who at the time was the artistic director, because he... I was so green. I was like 21, and I didn't know what I was doing. And they were so patient with me about it. At any rate, so I went into arts administration for a little while, and then I completely got out of acting. I went into music, and then I ended up getting. I came back to Chicago.
Are you singing the blues in Chicago, what were you doing?
I was singing with an a cappella group. So,
oh, were you?
And we were singing a lot of clubs and comedy clubs around uh-huh. Chicago, and then, you know, around New York, and we were in Las Vegas, you know, L.A., and so we were kind of like bebopping around the country doing it, which was really fun. It was really fun. And then I went back to Chicago, and I ended up doing, I think it was like a homemakers commercial, one other thing, and then I got cast in A League of Their Own, and that kind of catapulted me back.
You got cast out of Chicago for A League of Their Own. Oh, okay.
I know.
So you just, because I had thought that maybe I was just curious about how an actor of your training and experience meets bang into the young mom making cupcakes in a commercial for some company or whatever. Like me coming to Los Angeles, and I've done this training and everything, and the first commercial I go out for, I'm supposed to pretend that I'm marrying a Volkswagen, and we're walking down the aisle, and I'm holding the handle.
That was your first job?
Yes.
Your first commercial?
Yeah. It was my first audition. I didn't get it.
That was your first audition?
I wasn't in love enough, apparently, with the Volkswagen, because...
What, was it the wrong color?
Yeah, I don't know, but you're supposed to walk down the aisle holding the car handle, and now look at the car, and you're in love with the car. You're going to get married. You're going to marry the car.
I can only imagine what was going through your head.
Yes, and what's going through your head is, oh, what have I done? You know, what have... Yes, I'm
now,
in the Shark Tank
train?
Now.
Back east.
And New York City. And every scene study class you could imagine, and every
really?
Improv class you could imagine, and everything. But the theater improvisation, the Viola Spolin, and the games that were going on in Chicago... I didn't find back east. What I found, that's how I found doing stand-up, because it was the place where, like, hey, we have this stage here, and every night we all put on shows, and it's our own show.
Right.
And we write it.
Right.
And we act it out.
Yes.
And sometimes we make $10 in a cheeseburger. So I was like, well, I can put on a show.
I can do that for sweet potato fries.
Exactly. I'll do that then. I mean, I'll train during the day, but I'll go around and just do my own shows and write my own stuff. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. It was.
Was this in the '80s?
This was late '70s.
And the
early '80s.
How old were you?
I was 19.
Oh my God! How fantastic!
When I started working at clubs that I wasn't actually legal to be in, but I was performing in and had to hang out and act like I belonged there.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course.
But so you did a couple commercials, but boom! You're in movies. Did getting a movie sort of decide for you to become a professional actress, or you know, you did this big movie?
Well, I wanted to do it. I mean the other factors that were in there too is, you know, my brother John had done The Sure Thing. I mean, he had done a couple movies. He had smaller parts in it, and then he did The Sure Thing, which was his first lead, which kind of kicked it into gear for him. And Joni had also done a film where they ended up, because she was so good, they ended up writing scenes and stuff for her, which was amazing. My Bodyguard, years ago, and then she got on Saturday Night Live after she graduated from college. So the whole kind of film movie thing had already started, coming into the family and affecting, and you know, I'd wanted to sort of do that too. So I mean, I didn't know how it was going to play out for me, and part of me just feels like, you know, there's some kind of divine intervention that happened, because the odds of why I got that movie, it still confound me, you know, because I had really had no, I had sort of the training, but in terms of having any kind of resume, I didn't. I had maybe two commercials, an industrial and then the Homemakers commercial. So, I mean, I'd been around sets a lot of my life, so I was not uncomfortable with that or what the process was. But actually having had jobs, I didn't. So I was, still beyond my comprehension. I got cast in it, you know. And then, once I got that, I started coming out here, and then I got a sitcom, and they kept asking me back on that, and it just... And
oh, what sitcom was that?
It was called The Jackie Thomas Show. It was with Tom Arnold when he was married to Roseanne. And
well, if you're going to see, you start at the top.
Right.
League of Their Own, Tom Arnold sitcom, you're rolling.
I'm rolling.
But this was still out of Chicago. You were coming out here and doing it and going back to Chicago?
Well, yeah. And then eventually I just moved out here. Is this interesting? Do you even want to hear all of this stuff?
I'm just bored to death. And people are turning off their iPods.
I can only imagine.
Are you really? I enjoy talking
to... Let's talk about sandcastles.
We can do that. I find what I'm trying to do on the podcast is talk to people who've actually worked in the industry, who maybe people haven't talked about their lives, about how they've become artists, about their process, about the joy that they have in it. And I try. Sometimes I think I ask sort of interviewery-like questions, but I try to just have honest conversations with people about their lives.
That's the best.
Because to me, I don't know, I think I've said it on the podcast, look, he's long gone in everything, God rest his soul. But one of Spalding Gray's early plays in whatever it was, in the kitchen in New York or whatever, it was, you didn't know what the play was going to be about because the entire audience came. And that was when he first began the desk on the stage with a microphone. The play was, he's just going to pick somebody out of the audience and talk to them about their lives.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And people were fascinated by that.
Well, it is.
Because everyone has a story.
Yeah,
and things have happened to everyone, but I think especially within the arts.
Yes,
I mean the arts, of course, are celebrated and they're interesting to people. But to me, I think it speaks to a great gutsiness in young people, in you, in even me, in almost everyone I talk to who are artists, painters, dancers, and whomever, who said, everyone that I know in my life is doing the normal thing that everyone thinks you should do. I'm going to go and do this thing over here.
Well, I think that's true. I it's funny. I often think, like, if you're an artist, you don't have a choice. You if you have to be an actor, or you have to be a painter, or if you have to be in music, you really don't have a choice. If you don't do it, you are going to die inside in some way. You have to participate with the creative process somehow, and so you're forced to do it. And there's really strong, very clear examples of people who have absolutely no other choice about to be in the arts. I mean, you certainly are an example of that. You can go to, you know, you look at, like, the, you know, Eddie Murphy's, or you look at Frances McDormand. You look at, what are some of the really great, I'm blanking because I'm, who are some of the other, you know.
But I mean, the list is endless.
It's endless. You can look at, you know, Meryl Streep. You can look at De Niro, you can look at all of the greats. Robert Downey Jr., despite his, you know, his struggles with all of that, the great, you know, actors or artists, they don't have a choice. They have to do it. There's, like, kind of a calling. And I think within everybody, there you have to somehow participate with that creative part of yourself, because it's kind of like this life force thing with you. How it ends up manifesting itself. Maybe you're not going to be, you know, on the top of a billboard or an A-list, and you get, you green light movies like Matt Damon or something like that, or that kind of thing. But it's important that you participate with your part of yourself, because the creative process bleeds into every part of how you live your life and how you find your way through life and all of the struggles or the challenges that often we're continually encountering, particularly, you know, this day and age, which it's so hard, you know, because of what's going on economically, what's happening in the world. You know, we're kind of a culture of violence, actually, if you look at it. It's just insane. So we have to be creative about how we live our lives. And the arts and the training of the arts as we're growing up as people, or however you participated, is essential. We can't, you know, we can't, you know, be so limited that way. And some, you know, some people, you know, I guess to go back with what you were saying about, you know, it's very hard when you have a society that does not really support the arts or being creative, or even support you doing what you truly want to do. I mean, there isn't a lot of support. Like, you know, some people may have a calling to be glass blowers, you know, or they may have a great skill at carpentry and can build and design incredible pieces of furniture. But this society is not one that supports people really, even though it says it is, it doesn't really, you know, support people going for their dreams. And the fact is that there's fantasies and there's dreams. And dreams have, I think, very practical, step-by-step kind of things to making it happen. Fantasies, not so much so, but dreams can also have, you can make a living at it. You should be able to make a living at it.
And you could become an actor, but maybe it's out of your hands whether you become a Matt Damon-like guy or not.
Right, right.
And that's just, yeah. Who knows? I think Matt would even say, like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, no.
You just go out there and, like.
Yeah, I mean, there's the acting and the job, and then there's the business, because it's a business. It's show business. And there's a very real business that has its own politics, it has its own ego, it has its own financial stuff, all that kind of stuff, you know.
I'll just, a couple more questions, and then I'll let you go and do your thing.
All right.
But I just...
You don't have to.
All right, we'll keep going. I just love talking to you. I mean, think it's terrific.
That's so sweet.
I mean, I do. I'm a little bit fascinated by your belief in your lack of saying interesting things, because I think it's fascinating.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Has there been a role that you've performed as a professional actress?
Yes.
That not only you're proud of, but that filled your heart because you felt that all of that training, that time between 9 years old and all of that, really came to fruition, you know, within your performance of that character, that you thought, boy, you know, I just love that thing.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know, because each role or each job is so specific in and of itself.
Because you've used slices of that pie in different ways for everything?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of my training had to do was the idea that, you know, you learn about what your neutral is, what, you know, who you are. And then as a result of, like, emphasizing different things, you know, may shift physically so that how do I describe this? Where you live emotion, your body and your emotions are connected. So whatever you're feeling, your body is going to also reflect it. So if you are someone who is sees the world as half empty, you know, you're going to hold yourself in maybe a more constricted, tight way. If you feel like you're a victim in the life, you know, you're really going to, you know, you may be more closed up where you're, you know, crossing your arms and legs, or you feel you have to be protective, as opposed to someone who's, you know, say, 8 years old and life is just a complete state of wonder and discovery. So you're just, your whole being and your body is much more sort of open. So it's like whenever you're working on a role, it's figuring out, you use all of those different skills about how you find out what the spine of this person is and how they would move in the world, what kind of shoes they would wear or clothing, or, you know, what maybe, you know, imagining what kind of, like, books they might read. Not that it has anything to do with when you're actually on the set and they're basically saying, okay, go. You have to just, you know, you have to have all of that ready and there. They don't have, you know, they don't care about your process at all, you know. To answer your question, I guess all of the roles that I've ever gotten to play, I feel very fortunate that I even got to play them, you know.
Right.
And I would use different, you know, techniques or whatever it was that I've learned over the years to help me figure out how to play this person, you know. I
was just hoping you would say Maggie on Lifetime Television for Women.
Yeah.
But
because that's where Tom and I met.
Yes, that's where we met.
Oh, I wish you could have seen him on that show. He was so fantastic. Everybody just wanted him to keep coming back and be a regular. He did. I did.
I think yes, John Slattery was on the show.
John Slattery.
And John and I had a lot of, I guess, funny shtick to do.
Oh, you did. You guys were all about physical humor.
But you know what I think? I think ultimately the Lifetime people didn't like that, like, these two guys were doing shtick. I think that's the vibe that I got, was like, sort of, hey, guys, you know, like, take it down a level. Because we were just figuring, well, this is how to make a good show, right? If we're in a scene in an apartment, then we're going to make it as funny as we can. So, because it's supposed to be funny, right? So we'll do this, and I'll do this with the foosball table, and we'll do that, and, you know, and so we come up with a really funny thing.
You came up with great stuff. It was just so wonderful.
It seemed like it was, like, you know,
they felt it was,
guys, we're not doing a shtick show about two guys.
Well, that may be true. I think there was other stuff going on during that.
Oh, don't be coy with me about the downfall of Maggie that I still pine for. That was a recurring role. I was recurring on that show.
You were, and you should have been.
I forget who I was, but I came in as something or other.
Well, you know, you played Slattery's best friend,
yeah,
or something. You know what I mean? So it was really, you were so great. You just were so willing to go anywhere physically. It was just really amazing, you know, falling over couches or crashing into things.
I was
actually worried about your physical safety.
I got hurt on that particular scene because the director, I was supposed to enter just happily, like doing a dance. So, and then it was, I don't know what was going on. I mean, the full audience, this was, you know, tape night.
Yeah, I know.
The audience was full. They're in the bleachers and everything. And the director comes over and he's talking to the cameraman and everything.
Right.
And he says, And Tom will enter, and he'll be celebrating something, and he'll do something really funny. And then John will enter. I thought, I'll do something. He says, yeah, just come up with something. So
well, I guess that was confidence in you.
Right.
But
that was a lot of pressure. So I'm like, what can I do? That's fun. I have to just enter a room and get a laugh.
Funny.
Just standing there. So that's when I came in. Dancing, celebrating a little too much. I did a spin, tripped over the sofa, and then I just took out an entire, there was a turntable there and all kinds of vinyl albums, and I just went down big time. It got a huge laugh, but I was laying on the ground saying, that was the most painful laugh I ever have got. Yeah.
I love physical comedy. I did that once. I did a movie called Multiplicity, and it was with Michael Keaton and Annie McDowell. And he gets cloned. It was a movie about he gets cloned three times. And there's one scene where Michael and Andy and myself and Michael are in this restaurant, and Michael and his clone, which is Michael, see each other, and the whole scene then becomes about getting me and the clone out of the restaurant without Andy seeing us. So it's this whole scene where, you know, we're kind of running, we're panicked, and I end up getting my head slammed into a booth. Because there was all this physical comedy, you know, trying to get me out of there. And I ended up getting a mild concussion. But it was so much fun. Yeah. I just loved it.
Live by the physical shtick, die by the physical shtick.
It's true.
But
I still wish I would love to do it. That would be so much fun to do, a show where it just the whole basis is just physical shtick and comedy. You know, like a Clouseau, like a Pink Panther kind of, you know.
I don't know. I guess I don't watch very much. I don't see a lot of it. I mean, I see.
There isn't much.
Certainly there was all the Michael Richards stuff on Seinfeld.
Sure.
Which was Michael just doing his
shtick.
I mean, it was just a tour de force of physicality kind of every. But I haven't seen anyone, I think, approach a role where I said, I'm going to enter funny. I'm going to exit funny. I'm going to just whatever.
Yeah.
I could eat a bowl of cereal in a funny way.
Right. No, I mean, I don't think you're always entirely encouraged to do that, although they sort of want you to, but it depends on the show. Mostly it's,
I think
you know,
you're
concerned
not,
about how they're shooting it, trying to shoot it.
Well, after I hurt myself, you know, smashing into the thing, getting a huge laugh, I mean, they laughed for a long time.
Well, it was funny, Tom.
Yes, but then it was like, yeah, Tom, can we try that again? Like without the, you know,
the
maybe we'll get a chuckle. Maybe like a small, not just a gigantic.
See, that's the mistake. You got to go for the laughter.
That's what I always thought.
Yes. That's the point. It's a comedy.
I was on it. Did Peter Bonners direct any of the Maggies? Peter.
No.
Yeah. Peter's a great. Peter, for people, Peter played Jerry the Dentist on the Bob Newhart show when he was a psychologist.
So
yeah, and he's a very, I mean, he's directed a million TV shows. And this was a few years ago, and I was the, you know, the guest doing something on some sitcom, and there were always notes. There were always notes to not do this and not do that. And it seemed to me all the notes had to do with, you know, that funny thing you were doing? Yeah, we need less of that, you know. So I just said, you know, I took Peter aside. I go, Peter, it just seems like, maybe I'm wrong, you've worked way more in television than I have. It's a sitcom. I mean, I just try to figure out a really funny way to do it,
right?
And then do that, and then figure out those character things and those relationships around the joke. I realize that we have to have a relationship at the end of that joke,
right?
But the idea.
Right.
Is to make the joke as strong as possible around that. He says, right. Yeah, you'd think that, wouldn't you? You know, but that's just not how they think, I guess.
No, they don't.
Yeah. Do you, have you ever been a teacher? Do you ever teach?
Yeah, I did. I taught, you know, the games that I trained in, I taught them. I still teach them. I worked with the studio that I trained in growing up in my early 20s. And then when I came out here, I work with a nonprofit in Albuquerque, New Mexico called Working Classroom. It's an extraordinary organization. And I work with their theater program there. So I play the games with the kids there and because they have an amazing program. So I still teach them. I don't do it as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
But I did for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Now, are mom and dad alive?
My mother is. My father
mom,
passed away.
Mom, dad passed years. Away. He God passed rest away, his soul. But mom is here. So they got to experience the fruits of having so many children really follow their hearts.
Yeah. I mean, it was really great, too, because my my father was a writer, and he was also a film producer. He mostly did Growing Up as bread and butter while we were growing up. He did a lot of documentaries, industrials. He won an Emmy for a film he did, actually, on abortion in 1968, and he won Clio's and all that stuff, none of which I knew until I was a complete adult, which I was like, Dad, what's up with that? You've won these sort of stuff. I mean, he just didn't like talk about it.
Uh-huh.
It's like, so he wrote a film called The Jackbull, which HBO produced, and John and his production company also produced with HBO and John McGinley's company as well. And it was this great Western, and so that was really wonderful that they got to. And I went up to visit them while they were shooting in Calgary, and that was a great gift that they got to be able to do that together, you know.
Yeah. So this, I'll let you go, but I wonder, in your position as an actress with, you know, a very long resume, an incredible
it's
experience.
So extensive.
It's pretty extensive.
My credits are just, I don't know. I don't know who else has them.
I don't think anyone has them but you.
Yes, that's
specifically.
That's probably right. That's probably right.
What?
It's very specific to me.
Well, when the young actress comes to you, or any young artist,
uh-huh.
or any young person,
yes.
you know, with full of that desire
yeah.
in their eyes,
uh-huh.
what do you tell them?
Just be really clear that you want that, you know? I mean, if it's your calling, you're not going to have a choice. You're going to find your way back there. You're going to have to do it because it's the only thing that, you know, either makes you happy or you're driven. So if and when that's the case and you get very, very clear about that, know that there's the process, you know, that we love to do, the acting when we get to be rehearsing in the show or improvising or creating. There's that part of it. And then there's the business part of it. And so that's a whole nother component. There's the job, and then there's getting the job. And that in itself is a job. So there's a certain kind of business practicality that you should learn about what it is and how you operate. Manners are important. Always say please and thank you. Because there's not a lot of it in the industry. There's various levels of dysfunction. So it's when somebody helps you out or does something, you say thank you. You say please, you say thank you. It goes a long way. If people are on it, you're genuinely acknowledged. The other part of it is if you go on the more idealistic, you know, philosophical kind of idea about the importance of the artist in society, which is, you know, that's a whole other conversation and I feel very strongly about, it's, you know, be educated. If you're going to be an artist, there's a kind of responsibility to that. So have something to say. So, you know, learn about other ways people live, cultures, the history of the theater. Know what your profession is, the craft. Know about, you know, the architecture, the various histories of people, why we are who we are, what are the philosophies going on. Be involved in what's happening politically in grassroots movements and non-roots. Be informed. You know, the more you are evolved and developed, and the more your art and what you create and who you involve yourself with is going to be deepened. So make it a rich spirit, you know, experience for yourself by developing yourself. And take care of yourself on a very real level. You know, deal with your demons if you have them, and be clear in your mind, body, and spirit. We're continually works of progress anyway, you know.
Yeah.
But work on yourself.
How do you do that?
Oh God, I mean, you know, it's an ongoing process. I, you know, exercise. I'll, you know, I'm an Al-Anon girl, so I'll do, I'll go to Al-Anon when I need to go to therapy because there's a particularly period of time that's very difficult. I go. There's no, you know, particular shame in it. It's, you know, learning what is, what are your, the design, what keeps you from being who you are? What keeps you from feeling happy? And then addressing that sort of stuff. You know, and then life presents stuff as it always does. I tend to be a little bit more faith-based in terms of, you know, not a traditional religion in any per se, but I do believe there's something larger than ourselves. So it's developing those, that part of yourself too, your spirituality, quote unquote. You don't have to per se, but just, you know, doing all those, you know, those kinds of things, and keep making sure you choose things in your life that make you happy, you know, and that you, you give back as well, because that's a very, it's an honor when you can sort of help someone find their way, you know, as you experience when someone helps you, you know what I mean? So those are, would be sort of the things I would say. A little too much, a little too heavy, I don't know. Hey, keep a sense of humor. Always have a sense of humor about stuff. That would be the other key thing. Never take yourself too seriously, as I just took mine. Just don't do what I do. Don't do it.
I don't think you take yourself too seriously. I think that, well...
I was serious there, but...
Well, you were serious. Well, it's my, my old argument that I've made on the podcast and with many people, being so comic as I often am, but I said there's a very big difference between seriousness and solemnity, and I'm a very serious person, and we've had a very serious conversation without being particularly solemn about it. Because that's how people think you must be serious.
No, humor is the best way to teach anybody or to learn anything.
Right, right.
Humor.
Yep. Well, Aunt Cusack,
hey,
you're the best.
You're fantastic.
You are. La, la, la. I'm not even listening to you. The best. Thank you so much for being on the fabulous podcast. Are you anywhere? I mean, where do you sing? Where people could go and see you sing? That would be fun.
Well, we're actually going to try to line up a gig in February.
Where would that be? Do you know? Or what?
Probably at the M Bar, which is in
Hollywood. Okay, that's in Hollywood. Uh-huh.
Hollywood. And we actually do have a website. So
what's the website? Yeah.
www.bluesadjacent.com.
Bluesadjacent.com. If you're going to build a website, make it a difficult to spell word.
I know. I came into the band later. That's why. Otherwise, I would have probably shifted adjacent to something else.
Bluesadjacent.com. Not even Blues ADJ.
Anyway.
Well, thanks so much for everything. I appreciate
this is great.
It's you're always. And I told you, we saw each other at an audition, and you're just a joy every time I've ever seen you, from Maggie on Lifetime Television for Women to today. So thanks so much. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
I enjoyed our conversation a lot, and I sure hope that you enjoyed and profited from it. Thanks so much. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Thanks to Annie Cusack for her time. I appreciate that very much. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody over at the Nerdist Industries for their help. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for their help with my live coming to Syracuse, New York. Keep an eye out, January 17th. And after that, I don't have, you know, any gigs. So then I'll just be doing shows at my house as usual. 8:05 and 8:10 at my house. I do take a couple of balloon animals. And thanks.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.